My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I am Iron Man. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Post Credit Podcast. I am your host, Eric Italiano, senior writer at BroBible.com. And today, as always, I am joined by my co-host, Cade Onder, who you can find writing about video games over at comicbook.com. I almost said it again. I almost said, well, you could find writing about comic books at videogame.com.
Sure, works.
This week, we have a rare off week. There is no major releases this weekend, as far as I could tell, but it's not going to stay that way for long, because next week we'll see the release of the first two episodes of Obi-Wan Kenobi, which we will cover in depth week to week, and also the release of Top Gun Maverick. So with that in mind, this week we are going to be doing a Tom Cruise Mount Rushmore, which sees, as opposed to a draft where Kate and I would be going head to head, this one sees us sort of team up and try to figure out what are the films that define his career. But before that, we have a bunch of news to get to from this past week, some of which just dropped hours before we sat down to record. And that is a new Daredevil series is in the works at Disney Plus. Now, it will reportedly be, quote, a new but continued series of the Netflix show. That is a very vague statement. What the first thing that popped into my head was the distinction between Batman the Animated Series and Batman the New Adventures, which is basically like back in like the 90s, Batman the Animated Series is the one where he has the blue cape and the yellow logo, and then they tweaked it a bit to make it more focused on like the Bat family, and it became Batman the New Adventures, and he had like the gray suit and the black logo. So while it existed in the same world and the same characters had the same stories, the designs were changed, so it was sort of like a soft reboot type thing. So that is what I'm assuming is going to happen here. Like, they'll take the aspects from the Netflix show that they liked, keep those, and then everything else will all be built from the ground up. Now, I wouldn't say you're as hype on Daredevil as you are about Spider-Man, but you are quite the fan, correct?
Yeah, ironically, I never finished the third season, which I know is the best one, but
that's new.
Season three of Daredevil, no, people don't like that.
Well, I mean, it's been a few years since I watched it. I don't remember it being like the consensus best.
Okay. Maybe,
I remember season two with fucking Punisher was dope. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So,
I mean, look, three is good. They're all good. I just don't remember there being like a wow, season three, really.
Okay.
I think they're maybe all kind of just stone cold solid.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But I do love it. The only reason I never finished is because, like, it got canceled shortly after it premiered, and I'm like, you know what? I don't want to have my heart broken.
So. But are you going to go back to it now?
Absolutely. I've been planning to as of recently anyways, just for my own reasons. But yeah, I'm really excited for this because Daredevil and Charlie Cox are a perfect match, and that character is awesome. People are complaining about the writers because they wrote Deck the Halls, a Christmas comedy, but it's like...
And they also created the USA show Covert Affairs, which I'm not really familiar with. And this sorry, Kate, go ahead.
No, sorry, people say that show is okay.
No, I was gonna say that this is the result of the MCU now being a TV business as well. You need to hire TV writers to write the projects. They are spreading themselves farther and wider, and when you do that, you're not gonna get Aaron Sorkin for She-Hulk. You know, he's not gonna be writing the courtroom scenes in She-Hulk. Let's just be clear about that. Now, this was sort of an inevitable. Oh, and let's just name quick. The writers are, and not to diss them, I mean, I've never seen anything they've made, so I can't speak on it at all. I just know that USA shows exist on USA for a reason. Let's just put it like that. Yeah. The writers are Matt Corman and Chris Ord. Now, this was inevitable considering he appeared in No Way Home. They wouldn't just do that if there wasn't a longer term plan. There are rumors he's going to be appearing in She-Hulk, Echo. So this has been coming for some time. So the question is not, is Daredevil going to come back? The question is what Daredevil is going to come back as. And that is sort of what I want to talk on as something that's been a point of contention in the MCU TV experiment so far, particularly post Moon Knight, seems to be the rigidity in which they either make these series 6 or 9 episodes. Now, I don't think anybody has been made aware exactly what algorithm or creative strategy they use to determine which gets 6 and which get 9. But I know that a complaint that I had and a complaint that I had seen on Twitter was that the finale felt rushed. It just sort of felt like the finale of Moon Knight happened.
Right.
So I think a key thing to talk about is, do we see Daredevil being positioned as like a 6 episode event, which is what they sold Moon Knight as and went around telling the press every chance they got. Oh, well, it's only one season. We don't know if we're going to do season two. And then season one ends with a rock solid cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. So regardless of what they tell us, we can't even believe them. My point being is, I am hoping that this is a continual series. I'm hoping that they're not trying to do a one-year type deal. Given the sort of fan passion around the character, I imagine that that's the plan. Where do you see, or if you had to guess, how do you think that they'll roll out the show?
If it's just one season, I think that will lead into movies or a team-up show, kind of like the Defenders, but not the Defenders, maybe Midnight Suns and stuff like that.
Right.
I think Daredevil has a place long term on Disney Plus, though. Whether that is one continuing series, I hope it is, because I think that as a character that has a lot of rich comic stories and has great characters that jive well in terms of they have good chemistry over a 10-hour arc, right? Rather than 2 hours, Daredevil's the main focus, we're gonna move quick. I want to see, you know, Foggy and Matt Murdock hang out. That's what I enjoyed on top of the action.
Right.
So that's what I hope.
And then I think another major talking point that came out of this news is how Disney Plusified is the show going to be now? Was Daredevil in its original incarnation? Was it Human Centipede? No. But was it? You know, relatively violent. I mean, season three, there's a famous scene, which you've not seen, of course, but it's...
I know what you're talking about.
Daredevil covered in blood, just screaming in Kingpin's face, I beat you! Like, this is some gnarly kind of shit. So one of the immediate things that fans worried about was how sort of true to the character or the previous show will this be? And this, I think, is ultimately the concern that I have because, again, not to, you know, pile on the show, if we look at Moon Knight, all of Moon Knight's supposed brutal action was hidden under the plot device of Jake Lockley. And we never saw it happen. And it was just implied off screen. And if we get, and I saw your tweet saying we better give one of those iconic long one take fight scenes that they've done in every season. Cade, I hate to break it to you, pal. I hate to break it to you, pal. I don't see that sort of show coming out of Disney Plus. Now, maybe the next few shows will right the ship, right? I think Ms. Marvel looks legit good.
Yeah.
Does it look violent and dark? No, but it looks good. I'm particularly down on the MCU TV show experience right now because of Moon Knight. That could change. But just seeing what we just saw unfold with Moon Knight, that has me concerned with how far that they're going to be willing to push Daredevil when he does come back.
Yeah. No, I keep telling people like, hey, you're concerned about the writers. You should be concerned more about Disney Plus. Like that is the bigger barrier here because writers take jobs and that offers different variations in quality. But Disney Plus has shown kind of like, you know, we had Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which pushed some lines, I think, for violence in the MCU. I mean, you see what's his face's arm like snap, and like that whole warehouse fight is.
And I'd say his arm does snap in that scene, and when he does kill, I mean that. But again, it was implied.
It's violence.
Like we were all shook because whoa, there's blood on his face. Like that is the bar that Marvel has to clear, which is not very high.
Yeah, I mean, the first season of Daredevil has a scene where Kingpin smashes a guy's head into a door.
With a car door.
It's mush. That's just not going to happen. Nothing like that is going to happen. You might get some violence.
I mean, we've already seen what the Disney plusified version of Kingpin looks like.
Yeah, he's a fucking bouncy castle. He just jumps all over the place.
So... And I think it's fascinating to see how the culture reacted to this news. I think a lot of the response has been sort of like, you know, that meme of Wario where he's in heaven and it's like, I've won, but at what cost?
That's
basically this, right? Like, yes, we have gotten the character and the show that we've wanted, but there's a huge caveat, but it's a Disney Plus show, which like is sort of like a derogatory term. Not yet, but I think it's getting there. If Ms. Marvel bombs, they're in trouble because She-Hulk, which we'll talk about soon, doesn't look like it's going to be the throat clearer that they need. The only Marvel TV show, and I look through the list, actually, let me pull it up now quick. Okay, so the only Marvel Cinematic Universe TV show that I'm legitimately excited for is, you know what, Cade, guess. Here's the list. We've got Miss Marvel, She-Hulk, Werewolf by Night, which I would be excited about if we knew more of, but since it's still online, is untitled Halloween special. I don't know if that one quite counts yet. The Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special, Secret Invasion, Ironheart, Armor Wars, and an untitled Wakanda series. Which of those do you think I'm most hyped for?
The Holiday Special.
No. Secret really? Invasion.
Okay.
Point being, you look at that list, right? There's no sort of Falcon and Winter Soldier Loki type right. heavy hitter on the yeah. horizon where there are characters that fans have known and loved for a long time and can't wait to see. So if she, if Miss Marvel is not a hit, that is only just going to have a trickle down effect, right? Which will eventually lead us to the point of where we're almost knocking on the door of now, is something being a Disney Plus show a bad thing? And that right. is the ultimate conversation that we're having here. What is the Disney Plus brand going to do to a beloved character? And the fact that that is where the conversation seems to naturally, like, I'm not making this up of my own narrative. This is what yeah. I've seen online. People being like, but so fingers crossed I'm wrong. But right now, given everything I've seen, I am excited to see Daredevil come back. I don't know if I'm excited for a Daredevil show.
No, that's completely valid. Like, it's, I've said, like, I'm not going to be all doom and gloom, but I'm not going to get super excited because it's like, this could go anyway, you know, and I think it would, I hope Marvel knows, they're smart people over there for the most part, that people like this show for a very specific reason. They've put the original series on Disney Plus with its all of its violence included. They know what people like. They know what people don't like about their current shows. But also, I don't know, like, because there are a lot of people outside of us that are like, Moon Knight was the best show ever. And I'm like,
I think, not to disparage how people feel, but I think people sure. who are willing to look at it with a genuinely critical, subjective eye see its flaws. I think that the propulsion of it's sort of like a Snyder Cut-esque review blitz where like they go on Rotten Tomatoes and like spam upvote the reviews. I'm getting that sort of same vibe from Moon Knight, where in the fandom just doesn't want to admit that the MCU had a swing and miss. And look, I mean, I'm not thrilled about it, but I'm willing to acknowledge the truth. So
yeah, I mean, at the same time, there's a lot of very vocal haters on Doctor Strange, which I think they're crazy, but people who are like, this movie sucks, or this movie is not very good.
But that also sort of ties into the overall Disney Plus conversation that we're having, because now Marvel finds itself in a place where, I mean, just from the discourse I've seen this week, where people are like, is this franchise mid now?
Yeah, that's exactly it. There are a lot of people, I heard that exact thing last night from a friend who's a very casual moviegoer, but follows Marvel, and he was like, dude, Marvel's got me real concerned right now. And I'm like,
and then if you look at the,
that crazy.
And then, but if you look at the Disney Plus lineup of shows, and this is something that I had been banging the drum for a year, you look at the oversaturation that they're doing to themselves. And while you see a ton of projects and that theoretically should excite fans, not a single one of them get you out of your seat as far as I'm concerned. You know, I saw, and we're carrying on a bit long on this topic, so we'll wrap up quick. I saw today rumors that a quote, major summer blockbuster is counting down the clock to finish its VFX by the time it's done. And guess what film everyone thought it was? Thor 4.
Yeah, that makes sense. Did they say what it was?
No, it was the source I saw it from, which I think was Viewer Anon or some shit, but everyone in the replies was just like, oh, it's Thor 4, it's Thor 4, right? Because the trailer looked ass.
Yeah.
I remember when I saw Shang-Chi, I was like, Marvel could be on a bit of a run here, because I thought the Black Widow was pretty ass, but I thought Shang-Chi was very good. So then I looked at the list, and they had Eternals, which I had huge hopes for, No Way Home, Doctor Strange 2, Thor 4, Black Panther 2. You look at that and you think to yourself, wow, that's banger after banger after banger. Eternals, while not a financial bomb, was a critical and cultural bomb. No Way Home, I think its best features were the ones that had the least to do with the MCU in and of itself.
Sure.
Doctor Strange 2 has been divisive. I was a huge fan, but it has been a bit divisive, largely because of the Raiminess of it, I think. Yeah. And Thor 4, you know, people think Thor 3 is one of the best MCU films of all time. Taika is an Oscar-winning actor. Chris Hemsworth is the first MCU star to get a fourth solo film. 3 years ago, we'd be like, this is money in the fucking bank. And now the MCU has driven us to a point where it's the first film on people's minds when there's rumors about bad VFX. So I think that whether we like it or not, Marvel has pushed itself into a conversation of, are they sacrificing quality for quantity?
Yeah, I completely agree.
All right. Speaking of quality over quantity. Star Wars, they unrolled a massive sort of look ahead piece in Vanity Fair this week that teased Obi-Wan and Mandalorian and Andor and the Acolyte and the movies. So let's just run through sort of the big takeaways from that piece. Taika Waititi's film is expected to be the next Star Wars film to come out, although we don't know when, and they were particularly mum on the film side of things. John Watts, director of Spider-Man No Way Home, is confirmed to be developing a Star Wars series set after Return of the Jedi. Should we just run through them all and then sort of go back and share our thoughts, or do you want to? Yeah. Okay. Rian Johnson's Star Wars trilogy is still happening, but it's on the back burner while he develops the Knives Out films. Kathleen Kennedy said, Solo, paraphrasing here, Solo taught us we can't recast iconic characters. The Mandalorian Season 3 will release in late 2022 or early 2023, and Andor will release late summer 2022. Cade, what of what I just said sticks out to you the most?
I'm going to start with the Kathleen Kennedy comment about Solo, I think, because they say this as they're promoting a show about a character that is a recast of another character from the original trilogy. Talking about Obi-Wan, of course.
Well, while I hear your point, do you think she meant specifically for like the newer generation? Like, let's be frank, he was recast 25 years ago.
Sure. Yeah. No, like it's there. I just don't think.
And not that I'm trying to defend her, but you can't compare the media entertainment climate of 1997 and right now.
Especially because George Lucas was involved in all of that, right? Like there was a vision there that maybe wasn't there for this movie. But I think personally, that was not the problem with that movie. I like Solo. I like your t-shirt, the Northman t-shirt. That's sick. I need one of those. But that wasn't the problem with that movie. I like that movie quite a bit. Actually, I think it's one of the better movies of the Disney era.
Seth?
Solo.
Oh, Solo. Okay.
Yeah. The problem with that movie was you threw out your crew. And then it came after The Last Jedi, which people were already kind of mixed on. And it came out like 6 months after. Like, there were many, many other issues beyond, oh, you recast Han Solo. Because I think most people are like, we like him. He's okay, at least. Yeah, like, nobody hated him.
If the movie was good, people would have gone back for more. Period. Yeah. The end.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. It just, that's not what the problem was. And I feel like they're learning the wrong lesson there. But that's just me.
And now instead, they're giving us deep fake Luke Skywalker. Yeah, so they've completely pivoted in the other direction. I mean, look, Kathleen Kennedy, I would say, to put it lightly, is a divisive figure. I am not a overly passionate Star Wars fan, so I don't really have an opinion on her either way. I will say that this quote is just stupid. like to apply a Band-Aid rule to a unique instant in reaction to a very unique instance is just insane for me. That would be like if you fucked up on the podcast once and I was like, I can't have co-hosts.
That's exactly it. It's
like, just what kind of thought process is
it
that?
Is the most extreme reaction to something that was relatively minor.
Yeah. So, all right. What else we got here? Rian Johnson trilogy, they claim, is still happening. I'm calling bullshit on that one. I just don't see it.
They wouldn't say it at this point. Just be right. Like, what are you stopping?
I'm wondering if they are A, hoping that two things will occur in the next few years. The taste of The Last Jedi will fade away while Rian Johnson's star via Knives Out 2 and 3 continues to rise. So post Knives Out 2 and 3, Rian Johnson, I mean, people could be like, if those films are good, people could be like, this dude just ripped off three fucking like original detective blockbuster hits like that. People will be impressed again. So, you know, maybe they're just trying to, you know, keep the rights to them, for lack of a better term. So let's just skip that one. Nando, late 2022 or early 2023. I think we expected that. Andor, late summer. That's cool. I don't know if I knew that. They had been telling us this year. I think this is the first time that they've given us a substantial date. I think that the most notable piece of news here is that John Watts is developing what's described as like an Amblin Steven Spielberg 80s adventure type series set after Return of Jedi. I know our friend and old co-host Brandon Katz has complaints about things being set in the Skywalker saga. I agree. Yeah. That said, if there are two genre mashups that are made for each other, it is Star Wars space opera sci-fi and Steven Spielberg young, wide-eyed adventure vibes. That is an unbelievable, and that is what John Watts does. He is sort of an 80s kind of, people love to compare his work to
John Hughes.
I was going to say John Carpenter, which is very different.
Yeah, that'd be a weird kind of Spider-Man movie. That's the one where he has like spider arms.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, you know, people compare his work to John Hughes, which of course is 80s soaked. So I think that that is a very intriguing idea. Perhaps it explains why he walked away from Fantastic Four. You know, I would love to know whether or not it's actually going to follow kids, like kids in the Jedi Order or something. But I think it's fascinating to see how much news they gave us in regards to TV and how little they gave us in regards to films, and where and what that says about Star Wars as a franchise in and of itself and entertainment as a whole. Arguably one of the biggest American pop culture media properties of all time is focusing on quote unquote TV and not film.
Yeah.
But they don't even see it like that, because they, the one quote from there was, Star Wars is no longer about trilogies. It's about continuous interconnected storytelling. So they're sort of taking this in a very MCU-esque approach, which worked and still works. So I'm excited for what Star Wars has to come in the next few years. Them pulling it off is a different thing entirely. Speaking of, Cade, go ahead.
The one and only other thing was Patty Jenkins's Rogue Squadron is apparently also like off to the side.
But they said it's still happening.
It's still happening. But that was like, both the Rian Johnson trilogy and her movie were rumored a while ago. Like, hey, these are like shelved right now. So who knows?
Yeah. And we've learned that we really can't take their word for it at all. They announced a Lando show a few years back.
Really?
We have, Google it. They showed off a logo and everything. We haven't heard a shit about it since. So I really take whatever they promote or announce or try to hype up with a grain of salt. Yeah. It was like not that long ago either.
With Donald Glover. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So speaking about having faith in studios pulling things off, She-Hulk trailer dropped this week. And I have very little faith in Marvel pulling this off. Now, I made this clear in a post that I wrote about this week. I don't, and just because I know how reactive the internet can be, I don't want this to be accused of me having some kind of sexist agenda against Ms. Marvel and She-Hulk. And there was one more, Ms. Marvel, She-Hulk. Because my problems with the MCU's shows right now stem from fucking Moon Knight.
Yeah.
And I think Ms. Marvel looks quite good. I don't think She-Hulk looks good. I think that this trailer is sort of a nexus point for what we talked about at the top of, is Marvel mid now? Mid in many ways. Mid in terms of, is this a character that we need to see? Mid in terms of actual quality of product. People were roasting the CGI nonstop. Now, so let's start there. What do you think is to quote unquote blame for the CGI's quality or lack thereof so far? Do you think that's because it's a TV show and that's just what they are? Do you think it's because Marvel is overexpanding themselves? Or do you think they just don't care?
I think it's a mix of a lot of things. Not giving these people time. Like, if you ask a lot of VFX people, I love to keep up with this kind of stuff because I'm fascinated by it. They will tell you, if you're given time, you can make anything, right? And so time is the ultimate decider. So they need
James
time.
James Cameron, 13 years.
Exactly. He, and that shit's got crazy ass looking water, right?
Yeah,
so that's the biggest thing. Time, and then TV budget is obviously smaller, but Disney is keeps on saying, we're making, you know, movies for TV, basically, right? Like,
which has not been true so far.
Not really, no. Like, yes, this all looks way better than like CW or whatever. Right. But I still think maybe Peacemaker probably looks better than most Disney Plus shows, you know? So it's a combination of things. And I think they're just like, we can get away with it because people are going to watch it. And people are subscribed to Disney Plus. Are they going to unsubscribe for this? I doubt it. So, but the fact that this got trending, CGI, the term CGI got trending because of this. And I heard a lot of people who I normally would not hear comment on these kinds of things be like, that looks like ass CGI wise. I think the show looks fun, but the CG is fucking terrible.
So you're into the vibe of the show itself, because that was sort of my next point. She-Hulk is going to follow up Ms. Marvel, and those both look like inherently sort of light, bubbly shows. Yeah. And Marvel get away with that sort of tone back to back?
Be interesting. I think the idea, one is kind of a coming of age story, and the other one is like
workplace comedy type thing, right?
Yeah, like a lady embracing her sexuality, and
having some fun, and she's
on Tinder as She-Hulk.
Right. Yes, but those are still. But I guess my point is, they are when you compare those to the tone of even No Way Home, which was you know, pretty fucking serious. I think Ms. Marvel is going to be good. I think it's going to be a very sort of Spider-Man Homecoming-esque type of fun. She-Hulk has me extremely worried because it just looks like a sort of ad lib of MCU content, right?
Sure.
All right, let's get a, and again, I'm all for this, but this just seems like the thought process that led them to this show. Let's get a female lead, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's make it like The Office. Let's throw in some rom-com vibes and let's put it on TV.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if that's why people come to the MCU.
No, yeah, it is a weird idea for an MCU show, but one that is so weird that I'm kind of here for, especially with Abomination being part of it, where she's going to like be involved in his case or whatever.
Right.
Like his representation, which, I mean, it's been almost 20 years and this guy hasn't gotten a court case yet, a fair trial. I think there's some interesting ideas. I need to see a little bit more of it, but I am on board. But the CGI, again, is like, if how many episodes is this? 9?
Right? I don't know. I think so.
That's a long 9 hours of staring at that ugly ass face. Not her face. She's a beautiful woman, but the CGI face.
Well, that was my next point. Do you think that the CGI that we saw is the final product?
I would be amazed. I mean, this comes out in August.
Mm-hmm.
If they can really clean it up that much, like, because,
well, you hear about films and shows that come down to the wire, like when episode 1 of Peacemaker dropped, James Gunn was still working on 6 and 7, you know?
That's usually how it goes. They're usually finishing up the end of the series as the first one airs. Someone was saying like part of the issue is proportions. So she's a giant character. She's bigger than her normal self.
Right.
So trying to move a face and have the proportions can really look off. And when you have a character like Hulk, which is not as human looking unless you're Professor Hulk, it's a little easier. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if they address this directly, because I think they kind of have to. This is like not Sonic the Hedgehog, but like it's bordering.
I didn't even really notice it was. I truthfully didn't even think it was that bad.
The way I described it is like when you see a deep fake and you can tell it's a deep fake because like it's like someone is emoting underneath glue or something.
Right.
Plastic.
Good point. Okay. And then, you sort of touched on it. This series is set to feature cameos or supporting character roles from Hulk, Abomination, Wong, and in all likelihood, Daredevil. Mm-hmm. All right, let's swing over to everyone's favorite segment of the week, Kate's Gaming Corner. But Kate, let's try to keep it tight today because we've got some more to get
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely. The first one is, I'll start with the quickest one. Starfield has been delayed to 2023.
Boo!
it's really unfortunate news because this and another game Bethesda is making called Redfield, that's the name, something like that, were the only games they had for 2022 so far. I mean, this summer they'll have their showcase. They could announce something for the fall to fill its void, but that's a huge gap in your release schedule since like the last game they had was Halo Infinite in December. So that's, you know, significant.
Oh, Bethesda did Halo? I didn't know that.
No, sorry, I should say Xbox. Because
because what I want to ask is, are these Bethesda's first games since Xbox bought them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So that's, you know, it's good to see them taking time. They just said we need more time, you know, and there were some reports and rumors going around that it wasn't in the best of shape, like nothing maybe too egregious, depending on who you ask, but people are like, this is rough. So it's good to see them taking their time. That's the most important thing. But for Xbox as a brand, it's like, you've been fighting this, you got no games battle for a long time. And now this year you really actually have nothing. So
is this something that gamers, what does this news mean to gamers, to somebody like me, casual as it comes, right? Am I bummed that I won't get to play Starfield as soon as possible? Absolutely. But do I read into it past that? No. As a gamer, are you like, Bethesda, what the fuck? Like, is this a really bad fuck up? Like, are people cyberpunk gunshy now where they're really taking every precaution that they possibly can? What led to this happening?
It's both, actually. So I think a lot of people are like, Bethesda, we get it. Xbox, what are you doing? Because, you know, Xbox is basically the publisher of this. They are the business managers of this decision. And so everyone's like, Bethesda, we're glad to see you're taking your time. Xbox, this leaves you with a huge hole in your schedule. And this fall sometime, PlayStation will release the new God of War. And they have nothing to compete with. Yeah, so it's just like, what, we're over here. But
why does that matter? Why does that matter?
I think
because
part of it
the ever ongoing gaming wars and fight for. I mean, seriously, why does that matter?
That it's part of that. It's just kind of an ego thing. But at the same time, it's also like, I bought your box and I subscribed to your subscription service, and you told me if I'm here in November of 2021, and they gave a hard date when they didn't need to. They could have said we're planning for a fall release. Yeah, they said November 11th, 2022, over a year and a half before they needed to say anything like that. Right. And so everyone was like, that's really confident. They're like, we're sticking to it. And then they didn't. And it's just kind of like, I prepared for this. And now you're telling me I have to wait probably another 6 months.
Yeah. I mean, I've name checked this game specifically as like a next gen game that I am beyond hype for.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people bought an Xbox Series S, because they're like, I need something in the Series X isn't available. And now, you know, in that time, there could be more Series X's available. So it's just kind of like,
Right.
It seems inconvenient.
So more than anything, it's just a bad luck.
Pretty much. Yeah. But again, better to release a game that's good than rushing one out that's bad.
Absolutely.
The deadline.
Cyberpunk, looking at you.
Exactly. And the
hype for that game was astronomical,
absurd.
And the way,
I mean, the news of that game, it broke like.
And you know, we've seen this a lot over the last few years. I remember the Avengers game had huge hype. That was a pile of shit. So, like, I'm all for them taking their time to put out the best game possible. I was curious. Like, does this affect the bottom line business? Does the stock get hurt because of that?
Probably not, because Xbox again just has a lot of like other ways to make money with their subscriptions and stuff, and. Depending on when that Activision deal closes, you know, they could have a lot of games from their library to come to Game Pass, you know, day one. So that'd be big. The other big news is Silent Hill. A lot of rumors, leaks of screenshots hit the web earlier this week, and there hasn't been a new Silent Hill game in a decade. And you know, there was going to be one with Hideo Kojima, and it was canceled, and it was a very big tragedy.
Your boy,
my boy, he got hit hard by that one, and so everyone was really sad about that, and everyone's been longing for something to fill that void, and Konami's just like, you know what, Silent Hill, we're not doing anything with it. And then over the last few years there's been more and more rumors, and so the rumors start with earlier this week, some screenshots leaked of a game that has not been announced, and it was a variety of things, like just some environments and stuff, so nothing too specific, and some mentions of SMS texting. And this was a thing that was rumored a long time ago for Hideo Kojima's Silent Hill game, where you had to sign a waiver before you played the game,
and it was scary.
They'd send you real life text messages, and you'd have to interact with them as you play the game. So very interesting stuff, and that could be making a return in some form. And then the rumor continues on separately from other sources that multiple new games are in the works, a remake of Silent Hill 2 from the people who made the Blair Witch video game, An episodic series.
Okay.
It's okay. It's an all right game. An episodic series, possibly from Annapurna, who has their own gaming division, and a like core Silent Hill big budget game from no one knows. People think it could be Kojima since they're not putting a name on this one, but nobody knows quite yet.
What are the gaming world's opinion of the Silent Hill film? I remember seeing it as a teenager, not knowing that it was a game first, and it actually scared the fuck out of me.
It's funny that you say that. No one really talks about it. Like, you would think it would have more mention.
Isn't like Charlize Theron in that movie too?
Someone notable is in that movie, yes. But you would think, like, that's a relatively decent horror movie. Like, it's not the best thing in the world, but...
No, it doesn't star a famous actress. It does have Sean Bean in it.
Okay.
No, you know who it has? It has the actress who looks like Charlize Theron, but she is... sorry, we're going on a major tangent.
No, Carrie Ann Moss and Kit Harington and Malcolm McDowell were in the sequel. So
they made a sequel?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was 6 years later. I don't know if it's like a direct sequel, but I know Sean Bean was in it, so it's like loosely linked. But yeah, like those movies aren't terrible, but like they're definitely like on the
mid-end. She's the mother in Man on Fire.
Okay. Yeah. Yep.
But that movie, I mean, I'm sure it got terrible reviews.
32%
doubled its budget at the box office. So
yeah, I mean, like no one really looks at that as like I don't know, what's a really bad movie adaptation of a video game, you know, nothing like that,
right?
But I don't think it's at the high end, it's just somewhere in between. But yeah, Silent Hill is a very beloved franchise, and Resident Evil has kind of taken its place over the last 5 years or so. So with three titles in development, that seems like they're making an aggressive comeback, and that's promising. At least one of those has to be good, just mathematically, right?
Yeah, well, I thought that before plenty of times and have been proved wrong. All right, let's breeze through some quick hitters. We've got tons of stuff to talk about. Wall Street Journal dropped a new piece this week about Warner Bros. New CEO, David Zaslav. Sounds like he's going to run a tight fucking ship. Of the notable tidbits from the story was he axed the DC Project Wonder Twins film because he thought its $75 million budget was too high. He wants Warner Bros. To release 20 to 25 theatrical films a year. Studios just being like content is so fucking draining and so stupid. He wants to remake Warner Bros. To have a similar structure to Disney with separate entities with individual creative leaders for divisions like DC, New Line, and Animation, who will all report to overall film boss that oversees total output. And he wants to keep the budget of HBO Max original films $35 million and under. Budgetarily, I like where this guy's head is at. Mm-hmm. Wonder Twins would have been a fucking bomb, guaranteed. So smart move there. The 20 to 25 theatrical a year, I feel like, is setting yourself up for failure. Margot Robbie set to star and produce in an Ocean's 11 prequel film set in 1960s Europe. Sign me up. Teaser for the Predator sequel Prey dropped earlier this week. It'll hit Hulu on August 5th.
Looks cool.
Trailer for The Boys season 3 dropped this week. That'll premiere on Prime Video on June 3rd. Netflix is considering giving Knives Out 2 a 45-day theatrical window. WandaVision director Matt Shakman will helm the Godzilla and the Titans live-action series at Apple TV+. Kevin Feige says Loki has been the most watched MCU series on Disney Plus so far. Oh, whoa, a good show. People watch it. It's funny how that works. God damn. Kevin Feige said that one already. Amber Heard claims that Warner Bros. Removed a bunch of her scenes from Aquaman 2. Daniel Craig was rumored to be considered for a role in Multiverse of Madness. Cade, go ahead.
I mean, like, he was supposed to be Mr. Fantastic or Balder. No one can really iron out which one it was, but like apparently he was like in, right? And then COVID scared him
something
off
about
understandably. Yeah, like he didn't want to bring COVID back to his family in case he got it, so he said I'm out. But you have it here, would make a great Victor Von Doom, and I fucking totally agree.
That is the role that I would love to see him play.
Yeah, he needs to join up in the MCU as something. I need it.
Pirates of the Caribbean producer Jerry Bruckheimer confirms that they're working on a script for Margot Robbie. I feel like of all the actors in the world, she is arguably the perfect choice for this franchise. A new season of Black Mirror is in the works at Netflix. HBO has renewed Barry for season 4. Jack Reacher star Alan Ritchson has joined the cast of Fast X, and Pixar has released the concept art and plot synopsis for their 2023 film Elemental. Directed by Peter Son, who I think did The Good Dinosaur, the film journeys alongside an unlikely pair, Ember and Wade, in a city where fire, water, land, and air residents live together.
The Avatar.
The fiery young woman and the go with the flow guy are about to discover something elemental. How much they actually have in common. Elemental is an original film inspired by Sun's childhood in New York City. Sounds dope. Sounds kind of like an Inside Out type thing.
Yeah, would be cool. Which I'm
about. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're doing our Tom Cruise Mount Rushmore before my interview with John Hamm. All right, and we are back for our Tom Cruise Mount Rushmore. Now, we have done a Mount Rushmore before. We usually bounce back and forth between drafts, but a Mount Rushmore is fun because it sees us sort of team up instead of going head-to-head. Now, the last time we did a Mount Rushmore was back in August of last year. We did the Mount Rushmore of Mindfuck films. Our top five wound up being 2001, A Space Odyssey, the original Planet of the Apes, Christopher Nolan's entire filmography, The Matrix, and Shutter Island, which is a pick that I fought hard for. Yeah. Today, we are going with a Tom Cruise Mount Rushmore. We are trying to figure out, and here at Postgrad Pod, we do five, not four, because I said so, frankly. I don't really,
there should be five presidents on
this. Yeah, I just think that five is probably just a rounder. You know what I realized today? Are five and ten such integral numbers to mankind because of our fingers?
It has to be, right?
Yeah.
That's a deep fucking thought.
Holy shit. Why else would five be such a commonly used thing? Because I could imagine back in the Stone Age, we were like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And
it's that's just how it started. Right? Yeah.
So point being, we're doing five movies for Tom Cruise. Quick stoner thought aside. All right. So how we're going to do this is, well, let me make a quick few notes first. Tom Cruise made his feature film debut in the 1981 film Endless Love, where he cameoed as a character named Billy. Now, what I noticed when I made this list and I wrote out his filmography in Cade and Mine's doc, and Cade, to be clear, this is not every film he's made.
No, I know.
I just handpicked the ones that I think.
Crazy.
I know. I just handpicked the ones that I figured deserved to be in the conversation at the very least. So what we'll do is, because I realized this man is now, with the release of Top Gun 2 and the impending release of MI8, has made a stone cold hit in five straight decades, which is 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and 2020s. That's insane. So what we're going to do is we're going to run through it by decade, talk about the films real quick if we feel like we need to, any thoughts that we may have. There's going to be some that we've not seen, and that's totally fine because the debate is not so much about the quality of the movie, but how it fits into the context of his career and how we see him. So with that in mind, let's start with the 80s. In 1983, Tom Cruise stars in The Outsider. In 1983, he also stars in Risky Business and All the Right Moves. In 1986, he stars in Top Gun. In 1986, he also stars in Martin Scorsese's The Color of Money. In 1988, he stars in Rain Man. And in 1989, he stars in Born on the 4th of July, which he was nominated for Best Actor at the Academy Awards, one of his two noms for Best Actor and one of his three nominations overall. Cade, I think we have to include an 80s film in our list, at least one of them. I think it's probably fair to get rid of All the Right Moves.
Yes.
I think it's probably fair to get rid of The Outsiders.
Yes. Have you seen that movie?
No.
It's based off of a book that like all schools have to read.
I've read, right. Yeah. So that leaves us with Risky Business, Top Gun, The Color of Money, Rain Man, and Born on the 4th of July. Some people will say that The Color of Money is like Scorsese's best film. I've never seen it. Even if I have, I don't think it would make this list. So we're going to delete that as well. That leaves us in the 1980s with Risky Business, Top Gun, Rain Man, and Born on the 4th of July. I think that we should leave that as is for now.
Yes, I would say all of these are like seminal movies, like culturally, right?
Not
like,
even in the Tom Cruise context, yeah, in the cultural context.
Like you think of Risky Business, like the sliding across the floor and singing and, and stuff like that. Like,
that's in, that's used in like Tide commercials and shit these days.
That's the bar, right?
Great point, actually. That's a great point. That's something that I had not really thought about. Okay, so we're leaving the 80s with four films on the board: Risky Business, Top Gun, Rain Man, and Born on the 4th of July. Now we move on to the 90s. He stars in A Few Good Men alongside Jack Nicholson in 1992. He stars in The Firm in 1993. He stars alongside Brad Pitt in Interview with the Vampire in 1994. I've not seen that, but I really should. Have you?
Yes, yes.
Is it good?
An interesting movie.
But not good enough to be top five, I'm gonna guess.
Yeah, probably not.
All right, so let's delete that one on The Firm right now. 1996, he stars in the first Mission Impossible. Also in 1996, he stars in Jerry Maguire, which saw him nominated for Best Actor for the second time in his career. In 1999, he starred in Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, the last film before he died.
Yeah.
Coincidental how Stanley Kubrick's movie about secret societies among the rich came out and then he died. Interesting. All right, that came out in 1999, as did Magnolia, which saw Tom Cruise get nominated for Best Supporting Actor, his last nomination at the Academy Awards. It's been almost 25 years. Because in the 2000s, his career changes quite a bit, and we'll talk about that when we get there. All right. So the 90s leave us with A Few Good Men, MI1, Jerry Maguire, Eyes Wide Shut, and Magnolia. I think Eyes Wide Shut is gone.
Really interesting.
Because would you say that's an iconic Tom Cruise movie?
Maybe not a Tom Cruise movie. That's more of like Stanley Kubrick, like going crazy, right?
Right, right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Fair, fair, fair.
And we will take out Magnolia, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's a PTA film.
Yep.
It is. So you've seen that too.
Yep.
And?
It's very good. That's really all I have to say about that. It's been a while, but it is a very, very good movie. If I remember, it's quite long. Yeah, 3 hours and 8 minutes. Because so
I was going to say that one is probably going to get knocked off as well.
That it's hard because like that's probably his best like
performance,
dramatic performance. Yeah,
okay, so then for that point alone, it'll stay on for now, because I think that's a very fair point to make, because we could diversify our top five, right? Like one could be his blockbuster moneymaker hit, one could be his like critical dramatic work, you know what I mean?
Sure.
All right, great. Okay, so we leave the 90s with A Few Good Men, MI1, Jerry Maguire, and Magnolia. That gives us a total of 8 films so far. Risky Business, Top Gun, Rain Man, Born on the 4th of July, A Few Good Men, MI1, Jerry Maguire, and Magnolia. We're on to the 21st century. Mission Impossible 2 in 2000, Vanilla Sky in 2002, Minority Report in 2003, in 2002, The Last Samurai in 2003, a cameo in Goldmember in 2003, Collateral in 2004, War of the Worlds in 2005, his highest grossing non-MI film with $592 million, MI3 in 2006, a iconic role in Tropic Thunder in 2008, and Valkyrie in 2008. I think that this decade is probably the easiest to pare down. So yes. MI2 and Vanilla Sky are gone.
Yeah.
Goldmember and Collateral are gone.
Collateral is an interesting one because he's
all right,
like
we'll
first,
leave it
like,
for now. Okay,
villain role, you know, and that was like
true.
He's very scary.
True, he is great in that movie. He is really.
I don't know if he'll crack top five, but
it's worth keeping for now. Yeah. All right, so Goldmember cameo gone, Collateral is staying. I think War of the Worlds should stay. Not only is it his highest grossing non MI film, he worked with Spielberg, which I think is something to stamp. MI3. I think it's gone.
I got to fight. This is the one I got to fight for.
Really? I've never seen this one.
Yeah. Oh, my God, dude. It's,
this is the J.J. Abrams one, right? And doesn't Philip Seymour Hoffman play the bad guy?
Yeah. It's fucking... I think it's... When I came into this list, I'm like, I can't do two Mission Impossible movies.
Exactly. Because, and I don't think that this is going to be the one.
It was between 3 and Fallout for me because... 3 is like crazy good. Like it saved the franchise probably.
Yeah. All right. So we'll keep 3. Tropic Thunder is staying, even though we both know it's not going to make the top 5, but it's just such a fucking great role that we got to keep it.
This is the last horseman. Who is this?
This is Flaming Dragon.
Okay. Flaming Dragon. Fuck face. First, take a big step back and literally fuck your own face.
And Valkyrie is gone. 2010s. Now here, I think it's the first time where there's a potential sort of wobble in his career. Yeah. We're like, is Tom Cruise losing it here?
Yeah.
Not quite losing it, but people, I think, raised an eyebrow a bit. 2010, he stars in Night and Day, which, fun fact, hold on, let me just confirm that this is the film that I'm thinking of.
Isn't that Cameron Diaz, I think, right?
Uh-huh. Night and Day was directed by Logan and Indiana Jones 5 director James Mangold.
Yep.
Which is, I love that.
Why not, right?
What the fuck? All right, but not
strange movie for him, but hey.
Night and Day is still gone. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Not as good as Fallout. Still, it was a film that made people think like, oh, these MI films kind of bang.
Yeah.
But we're going to delete that one because it's not even in a top 3 MI film. Rock of Ages, 2012, gone. Jack Reacher, 2012, gone. Oblivion, 2013, gone. In that period, it was like, none of those are outright those stinkers, but they're
okay.
But now is where he sort of flips the switch and it's like, oh, fuck. Edge of Tomorrow, 2014. I think that this is one of the best sci-fi films of the last 20 years. I think that it is everything that's great about Tom Cruise, and it's staying for now. And that's just my thought. Have you seen that one?
Yes. Okay, I remember watching it on pay-per-view.
Oh, wow. Mission Impossible Rogue Nation 2015. Again, better and taking the franchise in the right direction. Yeah. But since you're passionate about 3, and I think it's consensus that Fallout is the best one, Rogue Nation has got to go. Jack Reacher 2. I can't believe they made a sequel to this. That's fucking hilarious.
It sucked. Like the first one's all right. Second one's not.
Yeah. Jack Reacher Never Go Back 2016. Goodbye. The hilarious Dark Universe attempted starter The Mummy, which I've never seen, but was one of the most glorious blockbuster disasters of the last 10 years. In fact, the tweet announcing the Dark Universe pops up on my feed like every 2 weeks.
It's so good.
it's so funny. Good.
It almost like it doesn't belong, but like it is like such a big moment in his career because it was like coming off this big comeback and then he just has this and it's like, what the fuck was anyone thinking?
Well, it was the post Avengers. We gotta make a team up universe ASAP. Yeah.
Just like, and so your first thought is monsters, universal monsters.
I mean, the idea in theory is kind of cool for me. Sure. I think it was supposed to be Jekyll and Hyde, Invisible Man, The Mummy, and I can't remember.
And they had cast for all these movies, like not full they cast, but like
Javier Bardem, Johnny Depp, Cruise. I mean, look, it was a good idea, but The Mummy just failed so dramatically that they just ditched it completely, which is very funny. 2017, American Made, which marks his first time in like a legitimate dramatic role in like 10 years. I've not seen that film. Goodbye.
It's all right.
I've heard it's not bad, but still.
Yeah.
And then 2018, MI Fallout. It is the highest grossing film of his career with $727 million. Finally, we're on to the 2020s. 2022, he's got Top Gun Maverick. And in 2023, he's got MI8 Part 1. So I'm going to keep Top Gun 2 on here just for the sake of the chat. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. We have 17 films. We have to pare down to 5. Now, let's do the easy ones first, okay? Let's Top Gun 2, gone, right? I mean, you haven't seen it yet, so you can't really speak
about it. Yeah, I mean, suppose. Like, culturally, like, it seems like it's a big thing already with him getting the award at Cannes that was like specifically made for him and stuff, but like everyone seems to be going crazy for it, but I just don't think we can talk about it at length yet.
All right, let's leave that one there for now. MI Fallout, I think it's got to stay for now.
Yes.
Edge of Tomorrow, I think it's got to stay for now.
Sure.
Tropic Thunder, it pains me to take off, but it's just it's got to go.
Sure.
The Last Samurai, has got to go. Minority Report, despite the fact that it's a great film and he worked with Spielberg, has got to go. I'm going to make your pick now, Cade. You've got to choose between Collateral and MI3.
I'll lose Collateral.
All right.
I'll fight for MI3.
Collateral is gone. Now we're moving back into the 90s. We've got A Few Good Men, MI1, Jerry Maguire, and Magnolia. Cade says Magnolia is his best dramatic performance, so we'll keep it for now. Jerry Maguire is probably considered to be like his defining dramatic performance, so we'll keep that. I think MI1 has got to go because we've got 3 and Fallout on the board already. And A Few Good Men, I mean, I fucking love this movie, and seeing him go toe-to-toe with Jack basically in the prime of his A-list career was sick. So we'll leave that for now too.
Lieutenant Kendrick ordered the code red, didn't he? Because that's what you told Lieutenant Kendrick to do.
Object! And when it went bad, you cut these guys loose!
Your Honor,
you had Marcus inside a bony transporter!
Your Honor,
you doctored the logbook!
Damn it, Captain!
You coerced the doctor!
Consider yourself in contempt!
Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?
This is gonna be hard, kid. All right, so now we're in the 80s. We've got remaining Risky Business, Top Gun 1, Rain Man, and Born on the 4th of July. Now, I think despite the fact that it's an Oscar-nominated role, I think Born on the 4th of July needs to go because, as you said, Risky Business, Top Gun, and Rain Man are like cultural staples. Like, they are touching points for that decade. So yeah. We've got to keep those. So now we're down to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
All right. That's way better.
Yeah. All right. So we've got... Six. Risky Business, Top Gun, Rain Man, A Few Good Men, Jerry Maguire, Magnolia, War of the Worlds, MI3, Edge of Tomorrow, MI Fallout, and Top Gun Maverick. All right, where should we start? Should we start in the 80s? I think a good place to start would be to delete one of the films from the 80s and one of the films from the 90s.
Okay. Yeah.
So, the 80s is fucking hard. My gut probably tells me Rain Man now, because the Risky bit, like, you're not going to see a Rain Man joke these days, but Risky Business, like, references still play. It's still relevant.
Yeah. Yeah. Rain Man's an interesting one, because that's like probably the first time like he gets into a movie that's like, because this was before Born on the 4th of July.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So this was like the first time anyone's like, whoa, Tom Cruise has got the shit and is in a really like acclaimed movie.
All right, so let's skip ahead to the 90s. You're gonna go for Magnolia over A Few Good Men, is that correct?
No,
you're not. All right, then.
I just, even though it's like probably like a higher quality movie, A Few Good Men's just like, you can't handle the truth, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You can't fucking compete with that.
Exactly. All right. So Magnolia is gone. War of the Worlds and MI3. Look, man, we have got an MI problem. I think that we've got to keep Fallout because it's the highest grossing film of his 40-year career. And I think it's, outside of perhaps you and a few more, considered to be the best.
Yeah. Like, the only thing I would put, like, the reason I would go to bat for 3 is like, cause it probably saved the franchise and there wouldn't be a Fallout without 3. Even like a lot of plot points from 3 come back to Fallout.
I consider 3 part of the originals. And then I feel like they made that shift with, I think it was Rogue Nation in 2011. Like, once they started to subtitle the films, I think that is when it switched.
I think there's probably some truth to that. Like, there is a much more heightened level of danger in those movies, pre and post, but there's something about 3 where the villain is good. The JJ Abrams's fucking, what is it called, magic box thing or whatever, like, works well in this movie, where he has a device that is never explained, but like the action, the momentum, the drama of the story. It's the first one where like Ethan Hunt is an actual like character, probably.
Right.
He's like settled down with a girl and Michelle Monaghan, and they're like together, and he's at a like party with her, and then he gets a call and he has to go to a 7-Eleven, and he's getting like a disposable camera, and another agent comes up behind him, and they're just like talking but not looking at each other, and it's just like cool ass spy shit, and Philip Seymour Hoffman is like
the goat,
killing it.
The goat.
It's
that's like, why he's the goat.
Exactly. I mean, MVP performance.
All right, so we'll keep three for now. We're not going to keep two MI films when it's all said and done. So
I got to fight my case, though.
In lieu of that, we'll take out Top Gun 2 for now.
Sure.
And we'll take out Edge of Tomorrow. So that leaves us with 5, 7, 8 films. Risky Business, Top Gun, Rain Man, A Few Good Men, Jerry Maguire, War of the Worlds, MI3, and MI Fallout.
There's no atmosphere at this altitude. I don't need you blacking out of me. Hey, your heads-up display is a built-in guidance system. Follow it. To the target, open your chute when the system says not before and definitely not after. Or the last thing that goes through your mind will be your kneecaps. Is that clear? Crystal.
Kate, I gotta be honest, one of the films on this list sticks out like a sore thumb.
I'll lose Rain Man before I lose Mission Impossible 3. I'll do it. I don't care.
All right. Then Rain Man is gonna go because I think we have enough to cover our dramatic bases with A Few Good Men and Jerry Maguire.
Absolutely.
So, all right. I think it's fair to say at this point, Risky Business, Top Gun, and Jerry Maguire are in.
Yes, I would say that as well. Yeah.
So that means I think A Few Good Men is out. Or no, because then at that point it becomes between A Few Good Men and War of the Worlds.
Well, I recently rewatched War of the Worlds like a couple of weeks ago. That movie fucking bangs.
it's on
Netflix.
It's been getting some play. So we've got Risky Business, Top Gun, and Jerry Maguire. I think that what we don't have yet is a legit cruise blockbuster. And I think that that is probably a good reason to put War of the Worlds in.
Okay.
So that leaves us with, as our selections, Risky Business, Top Gun, Jerry Maguire, War of the Worlds, MI. And so those are our four. We've got Business, Top Gun, Jerry Mac, War of the Worlds. Those are the four that are in.
Yeah.
We've got two left, MI3 and MI Fallout. Listen, I try to be conscious of, like, as the host of this show, like, not letting my opinion dominate.
No.
So if you are feeling passionate enough about MI3, we'll put it in. I objectively think it's the wrong call. I think that the highest grossing film of Tom Cruise's career has to be in. But I also don't think we could do two MI films, given how expansive his work is. So I'm going to leave the call in your hands. Are you going with your head or your heart?
I know Fallout's probably the better play because, one, I think that then opens the door for something like Top Gun Maverick to be as ambitious in terms of filmmaking.
Or to exist.
Yeah. I mean, I know they were going to make the movie for the longest time. Like, that was the plans from, like, the early 2000s or 2010s. But
I think the point that you're trying to make is that the last two MI films, I think, are what made Hollywood and the public realize after, as we touched on, that early 2010s period where he's doing Night and Day and Rock of Ages, where people were like, I think the last two MI films made people realize, oh, Tom Cruise has still got that gas.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Fallout is like, let this be clear. Even though I'm defending Mission Impossible 3, Fallout's a fucking amazing movie. And I show that movie to people. I mean, the opening sequence when they're in the hospital room and he goes, go. And the walls drop and fucking guy from CNN, Wolf Blitzer, comes out and takes off the mask.
Amazing.
I mean, come on. And all the helicopter stuff. I mean, and we wouldn't have 7 and 8 coming. So I think Fallout is the likelier play.
All right, there we have it. I feel very good about this, except for A Few Good Men.
I know.
No, I think A Few Good Men and Rain Man are the two that I feel like stick out. And I think if you were ranking this based on the best movies, A Few Good Men and Rain Man would overtake War of the Worlds and Top Gun.
Yes.
But this isn't a conversation about the best quality of films. This is a conversation about movies that define Tom Cruise's career. And if we didn't have War of the Worlds, there would be a gap from 1996 to 2018.
Yeah,
and we can't just ignore. Is that more than 20 years?
It is. It's 22. Yeah.
So you can't just gloss over that entire period. I think that's a good representation of Tom Cruise's career. I think that those early 2000s, early 2010s, where he was a bit lost in the weeds, he would still have films like MI6 to pull him back up, but he came out hot and he's closing hot.
Yeah. I mean, something I wrote down and just want to say, because I thought of this recently. I wrote this down because I thought it sums up his career. You know, you've heard the saying, if your friends jumped off a cliff, would you jump with them? And your answer is supposed to be no. If Tom Cruise was my friend and he asked me to jump off a cliff with him, I don't need any further convincing, because I know he has it figured out. He has it carefully calculated. I'm probably safer doing a stunt with Tom Cruise than like riding any roller coaster in the United States. Like, that guy, he's so smart. He has like the most wild career, where he is now, I'm a stunt guy who can act. Like, and I'm in on that. Like, I'm so hyped for Top Gun Maverick. I know you've seen it. I see it on Tuesday.
It bangs. It bangs.
It's gonna be. And then, you know, it seems like we didn't cover this, but some screenshots from the Mission Impossible trailer leaked out
this
week. It's nothing exciting. It's just like a couple pictures of him standing in places. But I imagine that comes with Top Gun. So
a full year plus out.
Yeah, that seems likely, because I know they were scoring it recently. If there's images of the trailer, it seems like we're going to attach this to Top Gun or whatever. And that makes the most sense to me. But Tom Cruise, man, I'm there day one, any day, any movie.
I think that's a great place to close. Let's just recap our Mount Rushmore one last time. We have Risky Business, which, let me just confirm I have the right year for this, because I've been saying, yeah. All right. Risky Business, 1983. Top Gun, 1986. Jerry Maguire, 1996. War of the Worlds, 2005. And MI Fallout, 2018. Honorable mentions that just missed the cut were A Few Good Men, Rain Man, and MI3. Now, stick around for my interview with John Hamm, where we're talking about the making of Top Gun Maverick, what it was like to tell Tom Cruise no, Boston sports, why people love the town so much, why he loves to make fun of himself so much, and more. Folks, today I am joined by John Hamm, an Emmy-winning actor that you know from projects such as Mad Men, The Town, Baby Driver, and his latest film, Top Gun Maverick, which hits theaters on May 27th. Now, John is a famed St. Louis Cardinals fan. I am a New York Mets fan, so I'll make sure to try to avoid throwing any pitches up and in. How are you today, sir? And thank you.
Very well. Congratulations. Your Mets are off to a very hot start.
Well, they are, but they're currently in the process of blowing a lead to the Braves. So let's see how I'm feeling by the time we're done chatting. So let me just start by saying congrats on the film. I had an absolute blast with it. And I want to start with the original Top Gun. What were you up to in 1986? And what would 1986 John Hamm have said if you told him that he'll be starring in the next Top Gun film?
I was up to about 15 years old. That movie was a very big experience for not only myself, but my entire friend group. And I remember going to see it in the cinema in St. Louis. And as soon as the movie ended, I realized I wanted to see it again. It was that kind of a thing. And of course, back in those days, seeing a movie again didn't just mean you hit the little circle button and go back and start it over. You had to go outside and buy another ticket and stand in line. That's if you could get a ticket, if it wasn't sold out. And it was a whole process. So I remember probably seeing it in theaters 3, 4, or 5 times easily, because that movie to me and my friends represented what it was to be cool. And it was the sunglasses, it was the look, it was the leather jacket, the F-14 Tomcats, the aircraft carriers, everything about it was cool. The music, the way it looked. So that was a big part of my life. Had I been told after walking out of one of those screenings, if some weirdo would have walked up to me and said, "Don't worry about it, kid, you'll be in the sequel 36 years later," my response would have probably been to call the police. But you shouldn't be whispering in 15-year-old kids' ears if you don't know them. But yeah, I don't know. I'm thrilled to have had the opportunity, and I'm very thrilled for people to see the film.
Let me just say to your point about that being cool, good fitting pair of blue jeans, white tee, and a leather jacket will never go out of style.
No,
it looks just as cool now as it did then.
Yep.
I was pleasantly surprised by how similar the tone was to the original film. Why do you think it was important for this movie to stay true to the Top Gun aura while also updating the story for modern fans?
I think the biggest part of why the movie works on so many levels is because what you say is true. The tonally, it maintains the same notes, but thematically, it actually has shifted over the course, because what happened in the ensuing 30 plus years was that Maverick got older and Iceman got older. And a lot of the people that we remember from the first aren't in their 20s anymore. And so words and concepts like responsibility and duty and service and loyalty and friendship and loss and grief, all of these things mean very different things when you're in your 50s than they do when you're in your 20s. And I think part of the fun for the audience, and part of why the audience can relate so much to this whole journey, is because they're invested in watching Maverick, for want of a better word, sort of grow up, and like we all have, you know, and have to deal with, you know, with kind of not being as selfish, and putting other people in harm's way is not the best way to go. And I think that those are lessons that we can all learn, especially in a time where, you know, this idea of taking care of the group and taking care of your community and taking mm-hmm. care of each other is seems to be a weirdly out of fashion. So I
contentious
think it's nice
debate.
To have,
yeah.
Yeah. I think it's actually nice to be reminded that that's actually the number one rule. Take care of each other.
And I think that that's what's great about this film, is that it still maintains sort of that genuine earnestness without feeling hokey.
True. And it's not preachy. There's nothing. Yeah. It's trying to tell its story, and it's wildly entertaining. There are some sequences that if you aren't blown away by, you don't have a pulse.
Yeah.
Right. It is a movie that is meant to be seen in a large format, loud and proud, and it will, you know, buckle up for this one, because it's a good one.
Now, I felt that your character was very much the moral compass of the film. Talk to me about creating a character who's forced to make difficult choices, even though they may not agree with them, but they know that they are the right ones, especially when those choices can cost lives. How did you go about bringing gravitas to that?
A lot of that was meeting a lot of the guys that were in the positions of making decisions and power and authority, and having to make executive decisions that you're right to identify could end up costing lives, could end up, you know, costing vast sums of money in destroyed material and what have you. So there are people for whom those decisions are made every day, and it's a tricky one. And those people by nature tend to be very sober, serious, calculating individuals, and that's generally why they have those jobs. So it wasn't that hard. It's baked into the script. The script is a very good script. Chris McQuarrie and others did a wonderful job on putting it all down on paper. But part of that was, as designed, was because that decision-making process has to be then met up with and rub up against Maverick's different decision-making process. And so that's where a lot of the dramatic drive and tension comes in the second half of the film.
You know, you bring up rubbing up against Maverick, and one of the things I have wrote down here was this pitched to you as, hey, John, can you come in and tell Tom Cruise no a bunch? That's basically what I felt like your role was.
I mean, it's a pretty cool job, I will say. I feel like that's a guy that doesn't get told no a lot. But I will say, I wasn't telling Tom Cruise no, I was telling Maverick.
Right.
Very,
right.
Very different experience.
So I feel, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I feel like when we talk about Top Gun, we have to talk about the late, great Tony Scott. Now, I don't want you to bail by saying Top Gun. So outside of Top Gun, do you have a favorite Tony Scott film, and why do you love that film?
Boy, you're putting me on the spot here for his filmography, but I think he made a movie. Did he make, no, that was Martin Brest. You're killing me.
Sorry, John, we can skip this one. Crimson Tide is always a classic answer.
No, it wasn't Crimson Tide. That was good, but that's not one of my favorites. There's one that I'm thinking of that I cannot pull the title, and True Romance was the answer that I was seeking, and I knew it would come to me eventually, but I had to look it up. Go ahead and roll that back, and I'll be happy to answer whatever you like.
Great choice there. So I said, I have to ask you about the town, because my friends and family, I mean, my parents who are in their 60s can quote every line of this film. And I'm not sure I've ever met somebody who isn't like, oh man, the town, I love the town. Why do you think that that film has created such a legacy?
Ben did a very, very smart thing when he decided to take on that project. And he's a phenomenal director. I think the proof's in the pudding for that. That was his second feature. I happened to see his first feature at a film festival and I was blown away, Gone Baby Gone. Mm. When it was presented to me as this is going to happen, and I thought, well, Ben's the perfect guy to do it. Not only is he literally the patron saint of Boston, he's also perfectly cast in the role. But he also hired tremendous craftspeople to make that movie, from our stunt coordinators to our director of photography to our costumers to our ADs to everybody to our second unit director. We had the editors. We had the top-notch, top-tier craftspeople working on that film, and it's all right there on screen. He decided to make kind of a throwback 1970s style action thriller, and it's just great. I had so much fun making that movie. Got to know Jeremy Renner really well on that film. We've made a couple things since then, and Rebecca Hall, Ben, obviously, so many folks on that film. Got to work with the late great Pete Postlethwaite. Mm-hmm. So you know, it was a real pleasure. It was a real fun experience getting to know Boston. I'd really never spent much time there. I've since made two or three other films in Boston, and I love it there. The sports teams I can do without. But
you and me both, brother.
I'm sure I'm gonna get dragged for that, but whatever, that's how it goes.
Let me tell you, hearing Pete's name, the first thing that I think of is I'm gonna clip your nuts just like I clipped your daddy's.
Yeah, he's a scary guy, and when you meet him in person, he's the nicest, gentlest, tiniest little Irish elf. He was pretty intimidating in that film.
You sort of led me into what I was going to ask next. You seemed to have an early indication that you were working on something special. Was there a moment, a specific moment, where you realized, like, people are going to talk about this film in 10, 20 years from now?
On Top Gun? On the town, for sure. You know, part of it is ineffable, right? You can't really describe it. But it has something to do with having a good time making it. If there's some sort of intrinsic joy or enthusiasm that's coming from making it, then that will come out on screen. And then some of it is just lightning in a bottle. I think that we had both of those things. We came out on the right weekend. We had the right kind of mix of release. Warner Brothers did an incredibly good job at marketing the film.
It's also endlessly quotable.
And it was very endlessly quotable. It hit that pure pocket of the movie going audience that wanted to watch it on more than one occasion. And that's the movie that I get recognized for more than anything else, especially in airport. It's very big for the TSA for some reason.
Because they probably had to go through a course like, here's how we prevent getting robbed like this.
You're probably right.
All right, I've got to wrap soon. So I want to swing over to what I think is probably the most underrated aspect of your career, and that's your work in comedy. Now, I'm a fan of soccer, and in England, they call this taking the piss out of yourself. You seem to be a huge fan of that, whether it be Bridesmaids or Parks and Rec or 30 Rock or even popping up on Kurt. Why do you seem to enjoy that so much? Because I find that you're clearly in on the joke of playing against type.
I think part of it is it's expecting the unexpected, I think. And that there's a lot of comedy that can come from that. I look a certain way, I present a certain way, and I think if then the action or the scene makes a hard left, then it tends to be funny. I did a very small part playing myself on Bill Hader's excellent show, Barry.
Amazing.
And it wasn't even really a joke. It was just me being an exaggeratedly dumb version of me. And we got to lean into it so much that Bill could barely keep a straight face when it was on his own coverage. So I was kind of like, you know, you're the star of this movie. You better stop laughing during this. It's really not working. I was very pleased to be a part of it. I've cultivated friendships with a lot of those people on that side of the aisle from a comedic standpoint. And it's always nice when you get asked to play in those sandboxes.
Well, John, whether it be seeing you pop up as the guy who says no in Top Gun or the beautiful moron in Parks and Rec, you're one of those guys whose name I love seeing pop up in any film. Anytime you show up, I am confident that it is going to elevate the movie. I thank you for your work and your time today, sir. Godspeed.
Thank you kindly. Good talking with you.
Thank you, John. Cheers. All right, and thank you for John Hamm for joining us today. I hope you all enjoyed our chat. I hope you enjoyed our Tom Cruise Mount Rushmore. I hope you all are as hyped for Top Gun Maverick as my boy Kate is. It absolutely lives up to the hype. I don't think it has a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes anymore, but I think it's still in the high 90s, which 96. Is just like, I can't believe he keeps doing this.
Yeah, and Top Gun 1 has like a 59 or something. I mean, there's a huge gap Like, that's a crazy jump between 1 and 2, right?
So not only do we have Top Gun Maverick coming out on the 27th, but we also have the first two episodes of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Now, given that I think more people will see Obi-Wan Kenobi that Friday than Top Gun, we're going to be talking about Obi-Wan Kenobi for the main portion of our show next week. But other than that, we will leave it in the hands of the Hollywood gods. Cade, my brother in Christ and content. It was good seeing you, dogs.
Good to see you, too.
All right, y'all. Peace.